go cherish this one.
Give this movie a big fat parish.
Does that make sense?
I don't know.
Welcome to Cherish or Perish, the show that has a head for business and a bod for sin. On this show, we rewatch movies from the past and pass ultimate judgment on their worthiness. Shall they remain cherished or shall they perish? We are your hosts. I'm Amanda Gimmel-Strauss with
Desiree Grobo.
And we have a special return guest.
Is this the fourth?
This will be fourth recording.
Fourth recording.
Jess Dungan is with us today. Hello, Jess. Good afternoon.
Hello. Yes. Hello. Thanks for having me back. So, again and again and again and again.
Yes. Jess was one of our first live shows. Then she was here for our Kurt Russell on Boats double episode. Then we recorded this episode about Working Girl a couple weeks ago. And unfortunately, there were some technical difficulties with the recording. So we are here again because we absolutely need you to know what we think about Working Girl.
Yeah. No. Amanda's over. She got over the boat situation that was really traumatizing for Amanda. Yes. when we couldn't get with Kurt Russell on one specific boat.
My Captain Ron heartbreak. I have healed. We're talking about this is one of your favorite movies, Jess.
It is.
So
yeah.
It's a brave move, and we appreciate your bravery for it.
Yeah.
Before we get into that, what has everybody been watching? It's been a minute. Technically, since our listeners have heard from us, but we all talk each other all the time about these things.
Yeah.
What's been exciting you other than Working Girl, obviously?
Well, I just finished watching the first season of Outer Range on Amazon.
Fellow watcher, that one.
I still don't know if there's going to be a season two. I don't know how I'm going to feel if there's not a second season of this show, because they brought up a lot of things.
Yeah.
And they don't resolve any of those things. I'm going to feel really that's a cheap move if they don't do another season of that.
Yeah. At first I want to be like, oh, it's sort of like when Twin Peaks only did the one season, but I will say they kind of resolved it at the end, and then they had to bring up a bunch of other stuff for the second season, and then none of that got resolved because then that got canceled.
Yes.
But yeah, this one was definitely like an 8-hour prologue season. So yeah, it's definitely a hell of a cliffhanger.
It's like an escalator to nowhere.
I haven't watched much of that one. I watched a little bit of it, but a lot of the shows that have that kind of what I would call a movie plot line, like a plot line that's supposed to resolve, like Lost or Heroes. These shows, when I watch them, I'm like, I know that I want there to be an end, but it's a TV show, and like how many seasons they can get out of it. And so like there's new twists, and then there's another twist, and then there's like, nothing's ever resolved in a timely manner.
Or it just kind of spins to a conspiracy that is so large that you're like, oh, I kind of am like missing the emotional heart of the show. Like, I feel like X-Files is like a show that did a really good job of having their ongoing crazy, like the aliens and the black oil and Krycek and this, da-da. But then, like, you had your Monster of the Week kind of thing, where it's like, it's a fun adventure.
Or more like a Bones totally. Or a Law and Order type of thing.
And we get to see
that.
Scully and Mulder do a weird thing, and it'll be like a creepy episode or whatever. And like, that is fun. But this kind of show, like, there really will never be that. Like, it is building.
It's a movie plot.
Exactly. Of like multi people, like, you know, multi POV of these people dealing with an unfathomable, truly enigmatic experience, for lack of a better term. Yeah, totally. So it is one of those, like, I need it, but if it doesn't happen,
I can lose my patience for those kinds of shows.
Yeah.
Because, like, okay, so like Stranger Things does it, but they resolve yes. the movie in the season.
Yeah.
And then they like, there's a new story. Like, I need that, I think, mm-hmm. in a TV show that's set up like that. I need there to be a relatively good resolution with maybe a new cliffhanger, but we got like the big questions of that season answered and we feel good about that, you know, yeah. as an audience. I like yeah. that.
And the cliffhanger
is time with yeah. like a Heroes or like I don't know Outer Range that much. That's why I'm like going to Heroes or Lost. Is I stopped those two shows about like the second or third season because I'm just like, no, you guys haven't answered anything yet. Nothing's been answered. Give me some answers.
Totally. Well, I feel like MCU movies are kind of like that. Like they'll resolve little things, but like the central emotional issues really don't. Like, nothing ever gets resolved. The world is literally in a constant state of peril that, like, the Avenger, whoever, have to go, like, face mm-hmm. up. But yeah, I do. I want some, tie some stuff up for me. And then, like you're saying, like, at the end, like, the cliffhanger is more like, whoa, thing. Like, this is the central thing that's going to happen next season. Like, I think about, like, when Buffy died. And then, like, you know there's a next season, so now it's going to be, what the hell are they going to do now that Buffy's dead? Or whatever, I don't know. Or maybe they were going to cancel that show, and then they ended up not canceling it. They're like, fuck, we killed her.
We gotta bring her back.
Now
what do we do? Like, the questions that we got answered in Outer Range were not the questions that I had. So like,
oh, that's, totally, absolutely. So no,
it's like, but when I think about that show versus a show like Severance, that also was... This is a season one was a prologue to this bigger thing that's going to happen, but like it was done well. Questions got answered. They raised new ones. What's yeah. you know, they raised mm-hmm. those stakes for season two, whereas without a range, it was like, fuck if I know, okay. Let's
Yeah. You really just yeah, it's like it starts out at a very high tension place. It ends at an even higher tension in the same things. Which is like, yeah, it's an interesting narrative format, but at the same time can feel like a bit of a cheat, particularly feeling like, you know, Josh Brolin is like the star of the show. Like this is an MCU guy. This is like a movie star. Mm-hmm. And so you're not really assuming that he's all of a sudden going to jump on for a multi-season television show, even if it is Amazon and even if they are like kind of mini seasons. But then you're kind of thinking, oh, well, maybe he owns a ranch in Wyoming. He's like, listen, man, I got kids. I'm down to just yeah I can go to LA, do my green screen stuff for those like action movies, and then I chill in my ranch and film the show, see yeah. my kids every night, you know, who knows.
I like, mean a lot of movie stars yeah. are going to TV,
absolutely, you know, absolutely.
Like Nicole Kidman's done like multiple shows for Amazon and HBO or yeah. whatever, Showtime.
I mean, for women particularly, they just get much better roles in television shows or serialized stuff like that compared to films. So, like, yeah, I don't blame them. Same with old, like, I think any older actor is like, well, I can't get, like, this
type I want to settle body. Down. I want a consistent salary.
Or just, like, I don't want to have to do crazy crash diets and these nutso workouts that damage my body in order
and to... learn a new character every, like, 6 months instead of, like, just settling down in a character and, like, getting... familiar yeah. with them,
or yeah, even just questionably good, you know. Like I think about like something like Hugh Grant, who is like this huge like rom-com whatever drama stuff star, and then like he just started doing really shitty like a little lower budget like romantic comedies that were terrible. Like I remember he did one with Sarah Jessica Parker and it was like, oh my god. And both of them, well, I felt I like both of it. These both of these people are slumming it to make this movie and it was terrible, and then it's just like, mm-hmm. well, that was it. We won't see either of you for 15 years.
I remember the poster for that.
Oh, just terrible. I can't even remember what it is. Readers, hey, maybe you're reading this on a transcript. I don't know your life. Get at us if you remember this Hugh Grant, Sarah Jessica Parker
Flight?
Romantic
Something?
Comedy.
Were they in witness protection? Am I remembering that?
You know what?
That
this sounds more interesting than I think this movie is. So we should write this. This is after record. We're going to write this witness protection romantic comedy.
That movie is for me is like I never saw that movie in the very similar way that I had never seen How to Lose a Guy in 10 Days until we watched it for this show, because like, it just looks like, I'm like, I'm not gonna let, I'm
you
not gonna
know exactly what happens in these movies. Yeah. You know what happens.
You know what's gonna happen.
There's no, if it doesn't, you're like, what the fuck? What was the point of this?
Unless there's something like really twisted or cool that they turn it into, I'm not going to be impressed if they make it together.
Like, I'm going to be honest with you. I don't think that's going to happen. Like, I just don't believe those things are going to happen. I did want to say the website, by the time you're listening to this, is gonzo. There is no more cherishyourparishpod.com. There is still at cherishyourparishpod on Instagram. I've been throwing reels up there like a maniac. Because why not?
And then like, there's like we have it on Buzzsprout, which
has you can find us on literally every podcast streaming app. We have our Buzzsprout website. Also, our Gmail at cherishyourparishpod@gmail.com. So you can still get at us. We're just not
where most people were consuming it anyway.
Exactly. there's people going to our website. Very few websiters. I'm sorry if you were loving that website. But yeah, it's gone now. But we thank you for still listening to us. Wherever you're listening to us right now.
Yeah.
Should we talk about this movie?
Let's get into this.
Let's talk about this movie we watched.
I'm excited. Weeks ago. I was tempted to watch again. I was like, I'm not renting this again.
I didn't want to rent it the first time. Yeah, me too.
Yeah, I didn't enjoy it.
We're talking Working Girl.
Once upon a time, there was a struggling secretary from Staten Island.
There is no paper in this stall. Get me some.
Who had a boss from hell.
I'd love to help you, but we can't busy the quarterback with passing out the Gatorade.
She was after a charming bachelor.
Big Jack, come out to play.
God, little Jack really has to get going.
Little Katie's been so lonely.
But he had his eye on someone else.
What did happen exactly?
The earth moved. The angels wept.
Little slut!
And that's where our story begins.
Thank God I'm here.
Catherine, what?
This woman is my secretary.
You're not her secretary.
You're like one of those crazed cops, aren't you?
The kind nobody wants to ride with. His partners all end up dead or crazy.
20th Century Fox presents... Yay! Harrison Ford, Sigourney Weaver, Melanie Griffith, in a new film directed by Mike Nichols.
You know, maybe I just don't like you.
Me? Nah.
Working Girl.
Working Girl from 1988, directed by Mike Nichols, starring Melanie Griffith, Harrison Ford, Sigourney Weaver, and Joan Cusack.
Plus all when sorts a secretary- of other folks.
I know. Oh, yeah. I was like, but who are we missing here? Lots. When a secretary's idea is stolen by her boss, she seizes an opportunity to steal it back by pretending she has her boss's job.
Yes, that is what happened in this movie. Before I watched it, for some reason, like as a kid, I really could not remember if I had seen this movie or not. I really think I just probably had seen the trailer. For some reason, I had thought it was more like an impersonation, like she pretends to literally be her boss, like says her name and stuff like that, which is not what happens in this movie. She just pretends to have her boss's role, but she doesn't pretend to be somebody else, like, which was nice. Like, I like that. You had seen this many, many times, Jess.
Yes. Yeah, it was on VHS, recorded off of HBO, I think.
As my favorites often are.
I loved this film. I think I thought it was about advertising. I think that I've completely forgotten the whole like day trading sort of
secure. And it gets
I forgot about it now.
Like, we'll get into the detail that this movie. Well, we'll talk about the efficacy of the detail that this movie bothers to include, and the business dealings of these people.
Yeah, they go deeper than I remembered.
Oh, yeah. It's a very technically astute film, I will say. Had you seen
it? Unnecessarily.
Had you seen it before we watched it for the podcast, Desiree?
I thought I had, but I had not.
Yeah.
I had definitely not seen it before. And I knew that very quickly, even with seeing the cast popping up on the screen. I'm like, oh, this is not the movie I'm thinking of.
Yeah.
Alec Baldwin's in this? Who?
Yeah, Alec Baldwin. That's a big name. Plays Melanie Griffith's character, boyfriend. And so, yes, basically in this movie. We open, it is the classic 1980s opening. It is an aerial shot of New York City. We see the Statue of Liberty. We see the tower. It's, you know, great. And also, inexplicably, a lot of tribalish. I hate to use that word, but that is very much the term that would be used at the time that this film was being produced. Drum heavy, slightly, could be African, could be Caribbean, could be South American. We're not sure. It's just tribal music. But yeah, it's just such a classic opening New York movie, like just right off the top. And we had talked about this a little bit last time, of just other movies are like, What About Bob? Like, has this kind of same opening, and some other films, which kind of threw me down the rabbit hole.
Stock footage openings.
But then also just like, wow, you know, thinking about movies that we had done for this podcast that had this thing. But then also just 80s comedies. Like, how many movies from the 80s we tend to talk about when we talk about like classic comedies or favorite comedies or the ones I recorded off HBO and then we watched over and over again. And I realized all of these movies came out in 1988. So I found, I made a list. All of the movies that came out in 1988 that, just a brief list. Big, The Great Outdoors, Scrooge, Dirty Rotten Scoundrels, which we have covered on this show. Cherish on that one. Beetlejuice, Twins, Earth Girls Are Easy, which we should do for this podcast.
Yeah, God.
Hairspray, Who Framed Roger Rabbit, and The Naked Gun. I could not tell you one comedy that came out last year. Maybe two. I could probably think of one. I don't know that I could think of two comedies that came out last year.
I don't think I could either.
Yeah.
They're not as prevalent and not in this style or like, well, this one, first of all, we've talked about this. This isn't really a comedy.
No, I would say that there's definitely a lot of romantic comedy elements, but definitely more grounded in a work drama. Yeah, more of a work drama. Absolutely. Did that surprise you watching this?
Yeah. I mean, I was surprised, especially because of the cast. Even seeing in the very beginning, like, these are comedians, basically. You know, yeah. Comedic actors. You got Joan Cusack. You got even Alec Baldwin, who does some serious stuff. He's always a little bit comedic in his role, even in his particularly stuff he does.
Yeah, and this time, like, I believe this is pre Hunt for Red October. Like, once he got a little older, he started playing more, I feel, serious roles. But yeah, in this one, he plays like a total meathead goofball. Like, yeah.
Even in this. But like, yeah, I definitely thought it was going to be a almost fully comedy, you know, with this like some elements of like drama, but not like not serious drama. You know?
Yeah.
I think my issue with it now, too, is like some of the things that would have been comedic back in 1988 are not funny now.
Yes.
Like the situation in the limo where we had the spontaneous Spacey sighting.
Surprise Spacey, spontaneous, unexpected Spacey alert.
Yes.
And yeah, off again.
Cringe Spacey moment.
Cringe, yes. Spacey. Not just that he is in the movie at all, but the character he plays is this guy, Bob, who is like sort of an exec or VP for another securities firm, who basically Melanie Griffith's co-worker set her up.
Pimp
her out, essentially. Set her up on a meeting, quote-unquote, with Bob, which he essentially is just drunk and high on coke and attempting to grope her in the back of a limo. And
gross.
Yeah, it's one of those things that's like watching it now, it's like, yes, we see that like Melanie Griffith was, her character was kind of expecting this and like,
yeah, and they describe her as hungry.
Yeah, and like she is not portraying herself as being terrified, just very annoyed and disappointed. But even then, it doesn't.
I don't know if it was supposed to be funny even before. Because like the tone, like, I don't know, the movie's tone is also doesn't have that comedic tone, even of movies of the time, like Dirty Rotten Scoundrels and Big. There's these like the sounds and the music and like the overall feeling of the movie is also comedy based. I feel
Mike Nichols thinks this is funny, and I think that a lot of people think certain things about this is funny, and this is not to say like they don't know comedy, but I do think that there is a very and I hate to gender it, but I do think it's a masculine type of comedy of thinking like, aren't we being so progressive by showing this woman who like, she doesn't get taken advantage of. She's so like, she's so jaded and tough. Like she's still trying to keep it all business, but like a true feminist statement would like not like Bob wouldn't exist. You know what I mean? Like a feminist fantasy, like we've talked about before.
Yeah.
Not,
you know, and Catherine wouldn't be.
Yeah. All of this stuff. Like there's so many things. A lot of the things wouldn't be. Yeah. You know, which I really, I got to talk about Catherine at length because it's just like her and Zoe's such a gem. But I do think there's a lot of things in this movie that are legitimately funny. And I think there's a lot of things in this movie that were funny at the time or for the context and things that are funny for the brand. And like when I think about a lot of Mike Nichols movies, none of them are straight up comedies, but I do think that they look for the comedy in adult life, adult situations, the way people can be funny in
real life, funny
in real life, and how adults and power plays and pettiness and greed and all these things—they do. There is humor. I don't disagree. Like even the movie Wall Street, is definitely a drama. Or Glengarry Glen Ross. Like these are dramatic movies about asshole men, but there's still comedy in their
shittiness. One's marketed like a comedy.
Yes, and I feel Working Girl was. Yeah, this movie is far more dramatic than I was expecting in a lot of ways. And part of me wonders, is it drama or is it lengthy scenes talking about securities trading? And
how can you make that into a comedy? You know what I mean? Like, it's like the job itself is so boring. Yes. And it's so funny.
Yes.
She should have been a clown. That would have made this movie funnier.
But the other thing also is like, of course, this movie stars Melanie Griffith. And why am I completely blanking on her character's name?
Tess McGill.
Tess McGill. Thank you. And so Tess is a bridge and tunnel gal. I think she grows up on Staten Island. And so there's a lot of New York. This is a very New York movie. But she is, I think, excellently portrayed as being an ambitious, career-minded woman fighting against that glass ceiling, and not only just like on a level of being a woman, but also of her environment. Class. They really show her boyfriend, played by Alec Baldwin, who is we are supposed to see at first as a good-hearted lunk, but then reveal he's cheating on her, and just sort of the expectations of this tight-knit I would assume a kind of Italian-American community, or a lot of the types of people that they're portraying Joan Cusack's character as her best friend. And so I love that kind of realistic thing of like, really, you're really adulting. Like she's, I hate the term adulting, but yeah, trying to level up her adult life. And so she is so grounded and realistic in a great way. And I don't mean that as boring or dragging down comedy, but like really emotionally affecting and like really grabs you. But a lot of these other characters are playing very big. Alec Baldwin, Joan Cusack, even Sigourney Weaver as Catherine Parker, her boss, which in that intro, we meet Catherine. She is just so stylish. We also meet that she's, I think, supposed to be 29 also, which is like wild. Because she does seem so much older, but I think that was so effective because when I think about when I was in my 20s and like just not knowing what the fuck I was doing, I would meet women my own age, but they were like very successful and like very glamorous and they did seem so much older. Like,
It was only realistic the way it is in that. Yeah. I think that they were portraying that very deliberately. Like
absolutely. And I love the way they did that because instead of just showing it, like, Catherine kind of, in my mind, was acting the way Tess perceives her. But, like, she's also saying these words out loud. Like,
yeah.
There's a scene where she's talking about, you know, we're kind of getting these little tidbit info about Catherine. Tess is getting little things, which, of course, we end up blowing up later, that we learn that the romantic interest of both of these women is the same man, Harrison Ford, a.k.a. Jack.
Are we sure it wasn't Richard Gere?
Yes, Harrison Ford does play the romantic lead in this. But yeah, there is just like the scene like where she, you know, of course things are like this, or of course things are like that, just talking about money and wealth and impossible things. Of course the secretary temp, like, has no access to or whatever. But it is so breezy and over the top that it is, like, hot. It is very intense, like, comedy. Oh, she's like, and I am, of course, me. Like, it's so wonderful, like, the way she just delivers this line. So, like, yeah, I'm thinking at the beginning things are kind of setting up, like, a more traditional comedy. And I'm all on board for it. But I feel where shit really goes off the track for me is the second Jack enters anything. Like... what, like, you know, like, things, like, start, of course, like, the tension starts, like, you know, Tess is there, she has this great idea about this client buying radio stations. This, you don't think you need to know this, but holy crap, about 45 minutes of this film is dedicated to getting this old man to buy some radio stations. Which essentially, Catherine steals this idea from Tess, reaches out to her love interest Jack, who again at this point we don't know who he is, nor does Tess know what he looks like. And then she goes off on a ski vacation. Catherine goes on a ski vacation and breaks her leg, and then is stuck in Switzerland. And Tess learns, like, on accident that she has stolen this idea. Blah blah blah. So a plan gets into place, where she will pretend to have the position that her boss has to sell this idea herself. And through this, she gets the motivation. She's going to meet this guy, Jack, which she does. She goes to a network event. She's at the bar. She meets Harrison Ford. Is like, I'm looking for Jack. Do you know who he is? And he's like, no, Nate, I don't know who he is. And let's not use names. Of course, he says this after she has given her first and last name, the company she works for, the project idea she has, and the fact
who
that
she was there meeting.
Who she was there trying to find, right. Which is himself.
Which is him.
Which is him. And then he gets
so he has all of the power in
all
this
the
scenario.
Power, then insists that she do tequila shots with him. And
when she's taken some sort of medication.
She took Valium, I think.
Valium. Yeah. Okay.
Well, she took Valium, but like tells him that she took an antihistamine, which I had forgot that she had taken. That value was what she had taken. It's like,
that's why she's like fall over.
She becomes like
up.
Shit face wasted. Then he takes her to his home,
carries
her clothes off, puts her in his bed where he proceeds to sleep in that same bed with his clothes off. I mean, she's not completely naked. She's wearing like lingerie. But then, like, I just.
Yeah.
Harrison Ford is so charming. He was like a crush object to me or whatever. Like, there's so, like, this was so.
But if he weren't good looking.
Oh, God. Yeah, he would be. If it was the guy, like the old man who she's trying to, like.
It was already creepy, but imagine.
Station, he would have been terrible, but it's already like. This is the kickoff to their relationship. Then she shows up next day at his office, and there he is.
It's supposed to be romantic. It gives this idea that it's supposed to be romantic. He took care of her. She didn't remember where she lived. If he had left her to her own devices, who knows?
Well, she didn't want to tell him where she lived because she couldn't have him go to Catherine's.
I just thought that
house.
She was too messed up to even really figure it out anyway.
But. I think it was basically like, he can't know that I live on Staten Island, but I can't actually take him back. I can't go to Catherine's house. Who knows what's there? Like, at this point, she has not started raiding her. I guess she had started raiding Catherine's wardrobe.
Yeah, because she was wearing the dress.
Yeah, I guess it was just too drunk to tell him, because otherwise he would have showed up there and be like, wait a minute, this is my girlfriend's house.
Right.
Like, and I don't know.
And like, just to put everything into context, she finds out that Catherine has betrayed her the same day, that night she finds out that Alec Baldwin is cheating on her.
Oh, yeah.
And so she has no place to go but back to
Catherine's
house.
Apartment. That's right. I forgot. Yeah. That was like the same thing. So she like basically.
But I still think that the movie was trying to make it seem like she would have. I think she would have allowed them to take her back to Catherine's house if she had remembered where it was.
Where it was, yeah.
Because I think
the movie would have been over, Desiree. Because
right.
He would have been
exactly. Hey, so they had to make it. They had to make it so that she didn't remember, you know, and that he had to take her back to his house. And, you know, just graciously give her his bed. But, I mean, he can't sleep on the couch.
But the other thing is, like, so when they they meet, and again, this is a very Mike Nichols thing. Like, I think, like, there was something very Warren Beatty-ish about the character of Harrison Ford's character.
Jim. I can see that. And, yeah, maybe it would have been better as Warren Beatty, even.
I wonder, because, like, so when they meet at the networking event, and it is where that line, I have a head for business and a bod for sin, comes from, he says something to her about how women are dressed at this business networking event, of how, like, women are all dressed at what men want, but wow, the way you're dressed, and like,
not the way men want, the way men, women, the way men would dress if they were a woman.
Yeah, something like that. And like, there was something very like Mel Gibson in What Women Where
she's
want
still
about
dressing
it.
Like a woman for a man.
For a man. Like, she is still dressing for the male gaze. Exactly. Yes. And what was interesting is, like, I didn't like What Women Want, but when we see Mel Gibson behaving this way, this is the bad version of him. Like, he talks that way before his experience.
Yeah, it's
where
a
he
negative.
Gets to the, but in this movie, we're seeing, like...
It's a positive. He's supposed
I
to be...
Think
well,
you're
I
both
mean, this
supposed
movie's perspective is that you should be able to be in business as a woman and still be womanly. And still be feminine. And not be so masculine. Yeah. And so, like,
but which
the
is
boys.
Like...
And I'm
why
like,
why is
like,
a man telling me this?
Yeah. Yeah. It's just like, you're like, sure, but like, you can't actually. Like, you can't.
And
you know,
also,
this time period.
Businesses have what are called professional workplace appearance policies, which are written by men and oftentimes gender what kind of clothes their employees are allowed to wear. And also, the other thing is this. We. In this world, like, don't know that this is Jack or whatever, and she doesn't know that this is Jack. So this is just a guy.
I mean, we know.
We know as the viewer, yeah. But like as Tess, she doesn't know. So she has no reason to flirt with this guy. She has no reason to find his jokes cute or funny. Like, she's into it. She's into being like, I objectified every woman in this room, and you came out the top thing I want to fuck.
It.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And, like, listen, being objectified, like, I get it. Like, I get that it is, like, that it can be a turn on, and, like, that is your own thing. But I hate that in this world, all of her career aspirations are tied up around this guy and his attention. And they do try to show, like, he thinks the idea is good, and even though he wants to fuck her, doesn't mean he can't respect her business. But I'm like, I kind of think it does. Like, I kind of think it does. Like, if she was not attractive to him, none of this would have happened. None of this would have worked. In fact,
if she was the secretary,
if she
none
was just the ugly secretary, he would have called up Catherine and be like, your dumpy ass fucking secretary called me, pretended to be you, and you need to fire her. And also, we're going to move on this idea that she had, and we're going to make a lot of money. Like, you know, it's just.
Well, I think that piece, maybe not, because, like, his character was positioned as somebody who really disliked when someone took other people's ideas, right? Like, that's his whole.
It was
one of his motivating factors.
Yeah, he got burnt. Catherine tells that story, that anecdote about him being burnt. Although, was that bullshit? Because she. I'm not sure. She's not reliable.
Yeah.
There are scenes.
But he was pretty upset.
He was. Yeah.
Yeah. There are scenes where I think we are supposed to see, like, Jack puts on a big show of bravado, but in fact, he's insecure. Like, he says a lot of swagger, but we see the confrontation they have on, like, the busy street when he thinks she's been like going behind his back, or because she was actually it ends up her plan to crash the guy's wedding, or daughter's wedding, and he confronts her thinking that she's going behind his back or whatever, and he reveals to her, like, I really need a win, I'm not doing that great, my career is kind of blah 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 blah. And I'm like, I do find that, like, humanizing of Jack in some way, but at the same time, like, this man is an emotional simpleton. And, like, the fact that he hides his tenderness through cruelty, while tragic is not excused cruelty or manipulation. And also, like, but it's one of those things is this movie does not see the things that Jack does as manipulation. Like, it's just, silly old Jack. Like, we are supposed to be like, oh, he's the best out of all of these people.
Mm-hmm.
Like, he's going to teach Tess how to be a good person or whatever. Like, it is a weird, like, place to try to expect. I don't know. Like, we're seeing that Jack does not access his emotions, except for in moments of rage, which, like, all right, typical, you know?
Yeah.
Like, nothing special here. So, yeah, I don't know. It just didn't... Yeah, I don't know. Yeah.
But what... I'm not... Now that I'm thinking about it, she's dictating. But I don't know who she's dictating to. It says, do not go through Tess. Had she actually sent it yet? Or was it to be sent, but then she went on her vacation and got hurt? Because when she comes back and she's like, oh, I did you see this? I could see how this would look, you know, but
yeah, on her computer.
On her computer.
Yeah, with Tess. That's what she, but I still think that she had been, because I think that Tess made the meeting with him on the pretenses that email was being sent. Right? That, like, she's like,
she was able to reach out to them. She knew where it was going. It was like,
yeah,
Catherine Parker to Jack Traynor, but I don't know.
Catherine, I think, Catherine lied and told Tess that she had this meeting and it flopped and the partners weren't going to go for it.
Right.
But the reality is she had not had that meeting and she was going directly to Jack. And I think she was going to try to kind of backdoor this deal, possibly outside of her own firm. I'm not quite sure. Again, it's not exactly clear. This is what's very funny to me, talking about, like, is there really drama in this movie or is it just a lot of business talk? And, like, one of my notes was, like, I felt that this movie was very stressful and you're stressed out for Tess because she is both kind of engaging in this subterfuge that, you know, she could lose a lot, because they also set up the idea that, like, she's gone through a lot of temp jobs. And so, like, her career options are getting slim, which, fine, that's movie reality. Is that what real reality? I mean, people, you know, if you keep trying, assuming you haven't gone to prison or committed like fucking grand larceny, you get a lot of opportunities to try and get in business. But they do set up a high emotional stakes for Tess. And there's all of these things happening. And they're like, you know, getting these meetings or they're walking quickly through a hallway and blah, blah, blah. But like,
yeah, this is her last job. This is her last temp job.
Right. And, like, Catherine, so
the
might
temp agency is not going to place her again if she messes this one up.
But with Olympia Dukakis. Olympia Dukakis.
And then it's just one of those things, like, is there a lot there's tension, but nothing really happens. At the end of the day, the whole plot, there's, like, no B plot. It is Tess has this idea to get this old man to buy radio stations, and she's got to get it done before her boss comes back to the office.
There's the romance is the B
plot. I guess the romance is
the B plot.
And
then, like, it's like she falls in love with her boss's boyfriend.
But all of that,
she wants to propose to her.
Is tied.
And her boyfriend is cheating on her. That's a B plot.
Yes. But, like, the romance to Jack is tied to the A plot. Like, the romance with Jack is dependent on this radio station.
Isn't that
thing.
How all B plots are?
I guess that's true. I mean, unless you're in a television show, like, for the most part, and you're seeing these totally other things happen. But it is, like, yeah, just whole sections where it's like Melanie Griffith talking about how, and if you amortize your bonds and then you could actually get a backdoor in on these radio stations, and then you can't have any competition from the Japanese. And then,
and then how she thought of that idea.
And it is just like,
we learn about even how she thought of the idea.
I was reading a magazine and then I like cut out these pictures from it and it was really great. I like to read all of the magazine. And I'm like, again, like, I don't make her sound stupid, but she literally, all of these people, this is not just her, but it's just like,
and also trying on lingerie. That's another fun thing she likes to do.
Yeah. No, she does not. She does not like it. She does not like it.
One time she doesn't like it.
Yeah. But the rest of the time, it's not discussed, right? It's not.
Yes.
She's just it's just those are the foundational garments that she wears under her clothes.
For her birthday.
This is the thing.
But no, but she doesn't like that. Remember that whole conversation is, I really wish that you would buy me something that I could actually wear outside of the house.
Yes.
And it's like, he's not doing that.
But this brings up the point of that she doesn't like it. The filmmaker is obsessed with it. She is shown in lingerie multiple times. Sigourney Weaver is shown in lingerie in a cast. It is the disc. disconnect of this so movie true. That this is a female empowerment movie that
and
has
women are half naked through a lot of it.
Most women are half naked. The two main women are like the only other major female lead in this movie is a villain. Is the villain yeah. that her biggest obstacle in work is
like one
of
my
other
favorite
woman.
Characters is the villain. The old, like,
the women who support her have like no interiority. Like Joan Cusack is hilarious. I love her character. She plays Tessa's best friend. But we at the beginning of the movie, Joan, like that character, has a job. She is also a secretary. She also works a thing. But by the time Tess is lying, she's going out to Staten Island and getting her clothes. She's running all this. Like, doesn't she have a job? Like, doesn't she have something else going on? Like, there are so many scenes that I do find very uplifting. Like, we'll get to the end where it is, like, we see these, like, oppressed women, the oppressed typists, celebrating, you know, Tess's rise. But at the end of the day, like, this movie has so little understanding of women. And has so little understanding of, like, how women think, how women talk, what women want, how women react in scenarios. It is, like, a women's empowerment through the male gaze over, like, writ large. You know what I mean? Like, it is particularly, like, those lingerie scenes. Like, there is a whole scene where, like, her and Joe Cusack, like, they're looking through the, like, the... Catherine's closet, and Melanie Griffith is asked to the camera, bent over for 25 seconds of the beginning of that scene. And it's like, why is this happening? Why are we doing this? Like, what is this for? Like, there's such an overwhelming celebration of Melanie Griffith's body. She looks great. She looks gorgeous. But like, yeah, it's just weird. It's a weird way that the camera follows her and the camera looks and frames her that is sort of like, all right. It's sort of like Playboy, where women become sexually empowered. <You know? laughs> And I'm saying, like, not saying that women don't become sexually empowered through, again, like, objectivity can be a very powerful aphrodisiac, you know, as someone who, but it has to be within your control and it cannot be tied to your career. Like, sex needs to be tied to your desire and things like that, but to, like, have your ability to succeed in business tied to your sexuality. In any case, whether it is you're sexually objectified by the men who hire you, whether you are denied things because of your queerness or whatever, what your, you know, any of that. It's, like, it's a yucky, like, role play is great because these types of power dynamics do come up and some of us are sexually triggered or aroused by concepts of power dynamics, but that's the joy of role play, is that we can live out these fantasies without actually tying our paychecks to the dangers of fucking our bosses or whatever. Like, and yeah, I feel that this movie is trying to, like, have its cake a little too much of playing that those dynamics without, like, really thinking about, like, what does this say about Tess, especially in counter to every other thing that we've been told or want to feel about this character.
It's wild. It's like, I feel like even from the last time that we talked about this to now, like, my feelings about the movie have changed a little bit, just, or a lot bit, actually. Because, yeah, I remember thinking, like, I was defending, like, oh, yeah, she's trying on clothes in a closet. So, I mean, like, why would she put her clothes back on between that? And I think you said something about, like, a robe, maybe? Yeah. Like, something, and, you know, but no, I mean, they made a choice. They made a choice to have her lounging around, look like, you know, milling around in lingerie like that was... That's something that everyone does. And it's not something that I do.
you know, and like, I feel like, let's say Greta Gerwig directed this movie and all the beats were the same. There is still a romantic thing. There's still this boyfriend that cheats on her. They're still hanging out with your friends and trying on clothes. I think there is something that is spoken about the intimacy of female friendships by casual nudity or states of undress. I think the same thing is conveyed about intimate spaces of men, like locker rooms and things like this. I think that they do convey something, but I think over time because of their overuse, that thing is sexual. Mm-hmm. Like the lock, I think it is only now that the locker room is starting to be reexamined as a space of male physical intimacy in light of like aggression. And that's like a whole dissertation I won't get into. But I think that because of the prevalence of the male gaze, that it is also needing to be reclaimed, that when women are physically exposed to one another in casual scenarios, like when we're physically intimate in non-sexual ways, that like emotional intimacy, like they're not synonymous. And I do think that like, and that, you know, that's all of us suffer from toxic masculinities. And I think that's a divestment of men from their own physical needs of physical intimacy and separate from their sexual needs of physical intimacy. But yeah, like, I think like Mike Nichols kind of missed the point. Like, yes, women do sit around in their underwear and try on clothes, but like, you know it when you know it, you know what I mean? But I also feel that we as not all just women, just, you know, people identifying in different ways or people looking for different forms of narrative, like this is what we had to work with. Mm-hmm. And I think that we can reorient through a different, the audience lens of what we're going to choose to take out of these movies. I think from an audience perspective, we have to, like, we want to enjoy ourselves. We can't just be fucking angry about everything we see all the time. But I also feel that it's fair from a critical perspective to say, I can look at this movie and I am going to choose to see it this way, but I know, I don't believe, like, I don't believe that that was accomplished intentionally. Like, I think that they were like, I want to see Melanie Griffith's tits.
Yeah. I mean, it was very deliberate, I would say. Like, you know, just because, like, if it were just every single time, you could definitely make a case for the why. You definitely could. But you don't need to do that frequently. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Unless your actual objective is to have her in her underwear frequently.
I have never once vacuumed in my underwear. No bra.
No. Oh my gosh, that was absurd.
Like, was she wearing heels when she was doing that too?
I honestly think she was wearing heels.
So
no, yeah. And like,
and no clothing.
I forgot. First of all,
that
forgot
I don't
that
do
scene.
Either. Was, you don't put your shoes on first.
In your boss's house.
Like, in my mind. Now, to be fair, though, I have, like, done things like vacuuming or cooking and, like, naked or underwear, but, like, not dancing around, not last minute, not like I'm in a hurry, and I don't put my shoes on before my clothes.
Yeah, in my mind, I told myself the story that she did not want to get dust on her clothes or something. Like, just, I don't want to get my clothes dirty from the kickback from the vacuum.
Yeah.
But I'm going to put on
and this
Louis,
was last, like, yeah. 2 weeks ago. This wasn't when I was 10 watching this. Like, I had, in fact, I'm not sure I remembered any of that.
It wouldn't have seemed weird as a 10-year-old because you wouldn't be objectifying it in the way that, you know, the
but like my mom doesn't do that.
And I also think like a lot of movies we have on here, I'm like,
she must be hot.
Yeah.
So hot.
But a lot of movies like I only saw later on television. So a lot of times they had a lot of that stuff edited out.
Right.
The other thing that makes me think is it's not just Melanie Griffith. In the scene where she walks in on her boyfriend cheating on her, there's a woman, like, they're naked.
Oh, yeah.
A fully naked woman is, straddling him, facing Alec Baldwin. Like, boobs out.
You have to assume there's a penis inside of her.
Yeah, penis inside of her.
Yeah,
this
absolutely.
Entire confrontation. There is a conversation that happens between Melanie Griffith and Alec Baldwin. This girl never hops off. She never covers her chest. If anything, she literally turns to face towards camera, and I will guarantee you Mike Nichols is like, turn towards me more, move your arm, pull your shoulder back, pull more, more. Like, he intentionally blocked her for as much in a rational world. If I'm fucking a guy, I'm riding this man, somebody walks in, I'm like, holy shit.
Yeah.
I'm using his body.
I'm rolling off the bed.
I'm
with the blankets happening.
And no, and she's like, What are you? I'm doing this on video. This like, where so you're gonna do this on video? Yeah, she's like literally like full turning, like nips pointing directly at Meg. Or I must call her Meg. Like, right?
She's been so inconvenient.
Melanie Griffith. Griffith.
Her arms are like arched back.
Yes, and she's just sort of laughing and reacting to this conversation like an unpaid extra in the background, like trying to get like fucking more screen time. It was crazy, and I was like, it just doesn't even make sense for this scene. It undercuts the scene, like. It's just, yeah, it was things like that that I'm like, this is why we need more female screenwriters, directors, like everybody. And like
a female
about,
screenwriter, if she gets a male director, that still might be in her movie.
Right.
You know, just as...
And when you're talking about like, I can always find a why for all of these scenes. I'm like, yeah, so could they. That's how they justified not editing.
That's how they justified
it. Was like, yeah, well, of course she'd be naked. She doesn't want to blah, blah, blah. Like none of that.
Yeah,
makes
why would you?
Sense.
Why would you put? Why would you put clothes on in? But you know,
you're
in
cleaning your house, and you're not worried. But, like I'm gonna be naked. Like what if I like fucking pubes?
100% of the time when I'm trying on clothes, even when I'm not with other people, I'm not naked for very long. I'm wearing the other garment until I find
like I
the next one to try on.
Pants,
you know,
and now...
like I'm still wearing the one I tried on before.
Right,
you know, so like I don't until I. Until I'm ready to put something else on, I'm normally clothed, and then I take something off and put it back on, especially in front of other people. Even if I'm comfortable with them, it's just going to be a moment of nakedness, you know? Like, you know, not
it's
a,
also a lot to
a
ask
monologue.
Another person, like, hey, you're chill with me just being nips out while I'm trying on sweaters here, like, blah, 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 totes normal. Like, again, though.
Wait, was she topless?
No, she had
I think she had a bra.
No, she, I think
she had full,
still,
the full foundation
full lingerie
going on.
It was just, but yeah, again, the opening shot, that scene, just trained on her ass for 20, 25 seconds. I'm like, yeah, there's no excuse for this. So things do start to escalate. So at this point, they crash the old man's
Trask. Yeah.
Which, how many characters have been named Trask in a movie? So get at us, cherishaparishpod@gmail.com. I want to know. I feel like there is a businessman named Trask in 5,000 movies, probably. Nice. It seems such a familiar. Anyway, I love this scene. I love this wedding. It is like Cancun themed. It's over the top. And this is the 80s before like
Morocco
themed weddings. Yeah, everybody's got like maracas and there's parrots and it's tropical and there's all sorts of shit going on. That was really fun. And it was like, if you forget about everything like Jack has said or done up until this point, like it is a very sweet time of like him seeing a real part of her. Like even though she's lying about her job title, like everything she's doing is her idea, her gumption, her charm, her...
Yeah, she's the one that's like, hey, let's crash this wedding
cleverness.
So we can talk to this guy. Mm-hmm.
And what I like about this also is that, like, when I think about something like Legally Blonde, or actually House Bunny is a great example. I love House Bunny. It's such a dumb, weird movie.
I like that one.
And in this movie, Anna Faris is a ding-dong. She is a dumb person. But it is through, like, her
endearing,
heart.
Though.
Endearing. It is through her honesty and her just sort of guilelessness and kindness that she like wins the day. And like her final monologue is just nonsense, but like makes sense when you look at the situation. That is not Tess. Tess is both charming,
no,
gorgeous,
smart.
Funny, smart. Like, and like she just has all the goods in this scene. And I really like to see her get to display all of this. And then Jack's like, okay, not that he doubted, but he's really seeing all of it. And like that is an exciting thing to see in a romantic comedy, is when the two or however many people are falling in love see the other person at their true best, and not just like winning the race like a lot of John Hughes movies, or like, you know, a lot of that was always like the guy has to go against the bully in like a ski race, a basketball game, in this case, it's just somebody being kick-ass. Like, it's sort of like you're out with your partner and, like, they're just really funny at a party and everybody's, like, you know, charmed by them. And they're just, like, and, like, you're like, that's my boo. You know, like, I love that kind of scene. And I think that wedding scene was that. Like, I really love that. And I think the escalation from that point like, really kicks off. Catherine's coming back. We find out Jack and Catherine are together. We find out Catherine wants to fire Tess. Like, everything is starting to snowball. And to me, that's when shit really started popping off for this movie. Like, the last 15 minutes of this movie, like, did it. Like, there's conflicts. There's heartbreak. There's will they, won't they. And
there's more business.
More business talk. A very darkly wood paneled room. She's the only woman. She is in the best outfit. Those pink glasses.
But then Sigourney Weaver crutches in.
Crushes in and is a total fucking dickhead about it. That part I don't necessarily like when you think of the overall context of this movie. That, again, yeah, this is the only other higher up woman. And if you,
yeah,
really
I hated that. That was my least favorite thing about this movie was I the didn't fact like that she was the villain. Like, I would have preferred it to have been Harrison Ford as the villain.
Or just some guy. Like, some,
just some guy. But like, it would have been satisfying, though, if it was this guy that she thought was, like, I don't know. There'd been something cool about it if she was able to overtake this guy that she had been working with.
Like, if Oliver Platt was the villain later.
Her old boss.
Yeah.
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
Her old boss or something. Yeah.
It was a lot of, like...
It had to be a woman. It had to be a woman. And she had to not only, like... She humiliates herself because she's kind of a bitch, right? Yeah. But at the same time, it is really humiliating and, like, dehumanizing in some ways in that end scene. That you're just like, you feel bad for her even though she's kind of a bitch, you know? Because she's had to put herself into these positions that maybe she's not ever even wanted to be in just because she is a woman. Yeah. And, like, I don't think that women... very frequently do this kind of backstabbing to other women as much as it's portrayed in films in real life. But I might be naive. I've never personally had any kind of competitiveness with other women at work, but like I'm not in the like Wall Street field or whatever's going on here. So.
Well, she comes from a place of privilege. Like, we walk into this brownstone. That's her parents. There's a war hall of Catherine. Or it was ostensibly a war hall, the four panels with the vibrant colors. Like, and Tess is coming up from, in comparison, nothing. Like, Staten Island versus Manhattan or wherever this woman came from. So it's like, not saying that she didn't earn the degrees and stuff that she had, but she didn't have to get in on scholarship. She wasn't going to have, like, somebody was paying.
She knew somebody.
Yes. And going back to that, I am, after all, me. Like, that tells you everything that you need to know about Catherine Parker, I feel like, from the get-go. She is all about who she is. She knows how to handle herself with these men because she's had to. But at the same time, like, she's seen it. Like, she knows how to work the chess pieces of this game. Whereas Tess is learning in school. She is, like, she's having to deal with it in the trenches. She's come out of a limo with Spontaneous Spacey, having to deal with, this is a corporate video and it's a porn. Like, you know.
Yeah, whereas Catherine hasn't had to deal with that as much. Well, she probably has to deal with it all the time, but no one's going to take her, going to do that to her because of who she is and who she knows. Right?
And if she lost her job, it would not matter. Because there is money to be, like, she has a security, her mummy and poppy or whoever she's talking to, like, she has like a Mimsy or some sort of name for them. It's like, she comes from money. She could go back to money. I don't feel as bad for her. The worst thing is that she doesn't get Jack Traynor, and he didn't really even seem to like her that much anyway. So
she didn't really like him that much either.
No, she
she just liked his status and what it would mean overall. Like, they'd made a good couple.
I don't know. She liked his D. Remember, she's like, can little Jackie come out and play or whatever? Like, I mean, yeah.
The thing to me, though, is like, I found like all of the views of women gross. Because in this case, it's like, Catherine is the only successful woman we see. But it's like, well, she's a rich girl. It's all nothing.
Yeah, she's not actually successful, I guess.
Yeah. She's not actually successful.
I feel like she is warranted in some of that success, though. I feel like it was more than, it was who she knows to get in the door. I think that that's true for almost any kind of possession like that. But I still do think that she must have some kind of credibility on her own to be there.
I think that's what kills me about this movie is that instead of looking at Why is Catherine the only woman here? Why are guys like Bob everywhere? Why are guys like Olive? Like, there's no, like, it's just sort of like, yeah, men are sucky. So women, you really got to work hard to be good. And it just dichotomizes these women. All the poor women are good. And the rich woman is bad. But we don't ever question, where's Jack's, how much money does Jack have? What's his background? Like,
oh, he knew people too, for sure.
Or just somehow, like, he had one idea stolen and therefore, like, his job isn't doing so great. But I'm like, maybe he's not good at this. Like, maybe he doesn't deserve to be. It's just one of those things that nobody is questioned except for Catherine. And that, like, by the movie, not by, like, people in the sphere, but by the narrative of this movie, Catherine is the only one whose everything is put in to question. And then Catherine, in turn, is the one who puts Tess into question. And so it just, like, rang so hollow to me of just, like, I don't know. It was just like, I don't need Mike Nichols to tell me how women should work together in the business. And Desiree, I agree with you. I think this concept of competitiveness and cattiness and like women tear each other down the worst. I'm like, I don't agree with that. Number one, the types of things that women may do interpersonally are just that, interpersonally. Men don't have to do that because you have devised a global system of oppression that does not give us even the right to make decisions with our own fucking bodies. You don't have to call me a fat bitch. You've already dictated my whole fucking life. Like, I'm not going to say, oh, not all men, blah, blah. But like, if you're talking about like systems at play in the world of business, men are not these like benevolent grandpas who are just like, we don't know how to change the culture while simultaneously saying like black hair is unprofessional. Like, it's a bullshit system that is just shifting a responsibility onto somebody else. That's my soapbox speech about that. But it is one of those things of just like, yeah, this idea of knocking down a few pegs. Like, Catherine needs to be knocked down a few pegs. And like you're saying, like, it is not an existential risk for her to lose this job. Like, she's not going to be out on the street. She's not got kids to feed, et cetera, et cetera. Like, she made a jackass of herself and will probably, like, go become a junior partner somewhere else, you know, or whatever. And so, yeah, we don't have to, like, worry, quote unquote, about Catherine in that way. But it's also, like, she's not, again, necessarily the person I most want to see humiliated at the end of this movie. Like, I would much rather see Oliver Platt. I would much rather see Kevin Spacey's character.
Alec Baldwin, even a little bit.
The Alec Baldwin, where it's like,
Alec Baldwin's character in this movie. Like, when I had COVID, I dreamt about the proposal scene.
Oh, God.
And when I woke up after that, I think I texted you, Amanda. I was like, I cannot wait to talk about this movie. Oh, worst proposal ever. It's like, I don't know. First of all, at 10 years old, he was the hairiest man I had ever seen in my life.
Just, he does have a lot of hair.
Like this winged, like a falcon or something on his chest. She comes home after work, getting placed with Catherine. She's very excited about it. He's carrying a pizza and he's concerned about the pizza getting cold. That was clue number one for me. Like, this guy's kind of a dick. giving her gifts that she can't wear out.
That are really gifts for him.
Yes, yeah. Exactly. Does not understand why she goes to night school. Thinks that she's supposed to be at night school, so he has sex with Doreen Del Vecchio, or I think that's what her last name. Doreen something. And let's also, this movie takes place in the span of what? A week or two? Two weeks,
very much. Tops. Like, absolute tops.
So, like, Joan Cusack's character gets married, which we knew that was going to happen. There was an engagement party. But, like, she's already, like, coming. Doreen's already, like, catching the bouquet and really excited about it. Like, they just broke up, like, days ago.
Well, we don't know how long they've been cheating on each other with, right?
Fair enough.
I do think also, like, a lot of that stuff to me was very, like, kind of representational of, like, the life that Tess is trying to move beyond. Mm-hmm. And stereotype, though. I feel that there is a very classist and paternalistic view of all of the quote-unquote bridge and tunnel people. Joan Cusack's mm-hmm. character, her whole family, all of the secretaries of just this
idea stand by your man mentality no matter what he does, too.
Like. Yeah, it's sort of this, like, they're good, hard-working, simple people. And it's always just a very, like, their lives... They're just gonna
get married and have babies.
It's this view that their interior lives, their emotional lives, the things that motivate them to get married, have children, the types of jobs they work are thoughtless. They're just animals. A dung beetle rolls dung. A Staten Island guy drives a garbage truck. You know what I mean?
And he marries a girl who wants to settle down, not a girl who has a head for business.
And, like, right. They knew each other in high school, and everything's going to stay the same. But, like, there are very complex and unique and moving reasons for why certain communities are the way they are, certain people. But, like, I just found it, like, again, this is a movie. Like, I get that. But, like... This idea, also, I'll say that this is kind of fucked up, and, like, this might be me being, like, paranoid, but it is very interesting that, like, everybody is a brunette or, like, swarthy, like, Italian-American, but Tess is this blonde, like, the two whitest people in the movie end up together. Like, Harrison Ford with his blonde hair and blue eyes and Tess with her blonde hair and blue eyes leave... Dark hair, dark eyed. It was like a Taylor Swift video where the brunette always gets this. It felt very weird that way because, yes, Joan Cusack's character, Doreen Del Vecchio, everybody are these Italian American stereotypes except for little blonde Tess. And, like, it is kind of.
She doesn't belong with them.
She doesn't belong with them. Exactly. Yeah. And it is, like, again, is this
a trophy wife, thinking? Actually, eventually.
Probably, yeah. Well, yeah.
What
gets me, too, is that, like, Alec Baldwin's character, Mick. I just kind of remember. He has a dream. Like, he can understand. Like, he wants a boat. He gets the boat. Like he knows what it's like to aspire to get something, yet he cannot wrap his head around his girlfriend trying to better herself. Like, why are you going to night classes? Why are you doing all of this stuff?
And it's like, you don't have to kind of a mentality. Like, as if it's a punishment for her to do these things. Like, he doesn't get why she would want to do them.
Well, it's a punishment to him. Yeah, he doesn't get this threat. I wouldn't be sleeping with Doreen if you were here on my dick. Like, that's, you know. Well, like, there was a moment. Yeah. There's a moment where, she, like, that seat is free.
It's her fault.
And Doreen comes and sits down.
Like, I mean, even Joan Cusack, her friend, has this, like, well, you know, you should come back to him.
He's so sad. He's so sad around. About you know?
Like, this is the thing that frustrates me, though. Like, I find these things, these two dichotomies of these worlds, of the expectations of the emotional, like, handling that is expected of women in Tess's, like, community of origin. And then when she gets to business world, there's other complicated and conflicting ideas of how women should be. Should women dress one way or should women dress another way? Should Catherine be tough or should Catherine be soft? Should Tess be this?
She doesn't have any female support at all, which is just so untrue in, like, the reality, I think, of the world.
Well, of the,
like,
working world, of all these other secretaries that she works with. And so the one thing that's frustrating to me is that Mike Nichols or the writers don't even realize they're doing this. They don't even realize how much they're highlighting, like, how these other women's lives are ruled by the expectations of masculine behavior. Mick is threatened that he will not be the breadwinner because every man he's ever known, his father, his uncles, his grandfather, his great-grandfather, have always provided for a wife who stayed home with a bunch of kids. But, like, there is not the economic
examination.
Lived
a modest life.
Because of just, like, the way women weren't allowed to have fucking property. They weren't allowed to have credit cards. They couldn't, like, everything was different. Women weren't allowed to work. And so, like, many people follow in these footsteps, not examining the economic realities that created this culture. And again, it is toxic. It is a toxic culture that limits people by their gender, that has expectations literally based on their genitals. If you have a vagina or a penis, you're one way or the other. And, like, what I find frustrating about this movie as a you know, something that's like a modern, you know, a feminist, blah, blah. It's like, it's so unself-aware about these things. Mm-hmm. And like, from an anthropological perspective, it's like, you're just whiplash from and, like the fact cognitive that, like,
people at the time and this would back that up, like that this is a feminist movie, and it's like,
or even still today, because these are cultural stereotypes or expectations that men have from themselves that they still have. And I think it's awesome that, and it does take men. It is men doing the emotional work to divest themselves from concepts of what makes them a man, of earning potential, or the types of jobs they do, or the types of women that they are in relationships with. And like, that is hard. This movie touches on how hard it is to leave the cultural expectations of everyone you've known and your families and your friends, but like in the world, like in the most surface way of just Tess making money and getting a haircut. But she does it great. And like, it gets us to that final scene. And so that, this is where that 15 minutes happens. Like, yes, we see Catherine humiliate herself, but what do we see? She, you know, Tess makes the deal, and the guy says, like, I have a job for you, but it's entry level. And so as a viewer, like, entry level, this motherfucker, like, he's just going to make her another secretary at his company. And, you know, Tess is kind of thinking that too. She shows up, she goes to sit in the secretary's desk, but nope, she's got her own office. And it's not big, but it's her
where
own
her
office.
Where her secretary is just chilling.
And she has a secretary. Chilling. And like, Jack's not in that office. That old man is not in that office. It's Tess, it's her secretary, who is a woman, and her friends, who are women, on the phone. And you're just like, yeah, like, it just feels so good. It feels so fucking good. And it's almost like the real reality of, like, it was worth slogging through that hour and a half of bullshit to see Tess in this little fucking office, like, in a high rise. Like, that is such a incredible moment. It's so satisfying. It's so satisfying that it's like, I'm tearing up thinking about it. Is it satisfying enough, though, that I had to just fucking endure all that other shit? And that is the question that women have to ask themselves every single fucking day of their lives. Is what I have worth it? And, like, again, I don't feel that this movie knew it was asking that question. So it's so interesting to think of it from that way. Like, it is a feminist movie, but one in, like, not in the way I think it thinks it is. It's like a feminist documentary of, like, this is the bullshit.
Yes.
This is the bullshit.
Because there, like, the fact that this movie was made is a little bit bullshit.
It's like an exercise, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, there was so much potential to have more to do with the secretarial pool. Like, bring in, instead of having Joan Cusack doing all of that stuff, rewrite that character to be somebody who's in the business too. Somebody that's kind of, supports her. That's not my dream, but I support your dream. Which, she kind of does that, but she does that with that, through that lens of,
this isn't, I don't understand you.
Yeah, I don't get it. The line about, like, sometimes I put on my underwear and sing in my house, but that don't make me Madonna or whatever.
Right.
Never will. Yeah.
She's like saying, like, we're different, but I don't get you and I don't agree with you, and you should be like me.
Yeah.
Like, you know, kind
and it's
of
like,
almost.
Let's explore that more. Like, what has happened in this woman's life that she feels, and I know that person. You know what I mean? I could be that person. Like, you're so defeated that you just reject the whole system, that you're going to be an anarchist, but you're not. You'll end up just stuck in the same position as before because your options are so limited. But, like, I wanted to kind of, talking about Catherine and also Joan Cusack to a lesser extent, it reminds me a lot of, in Hello Again, I cannot remember the name of the actress or the character, but the woman who marries Shelley Long's husband.
Yeah, I remember her.
After she dies, which, talk about quick turnaround. That movie, like, she's there for 6 months and, like, literally everybody's fucking life's changed. And at the end of the movie, who is the biggest maniac towards Shelley Long? It's her.
It's her friend. Yeah,
and it's,
or her
so
enemy.
Frustrating. And it's like, how great would it be if something twists around? How great would it be if Catherine's like, I respect your motivation. Like, this is a tough world and you got to make tough decisions and I'm sorry I hurt you. but I hope you understand, whatever. And not to say, like, this absolves Catherine, but at the same time, like, does not make her the greatest villain of the movie, which is exactly what happens. She
there are
the
so many
villain.
Movies that put women... That's I mean, what? Even Death Becomes Her, which I think we cherish
yes.
for different reasons, but, like, they're put against each other. Like,
absolutely.
It's always women against women.
And with Death Becomes Her, I think that is, like, sort of the intention.
It's almost,
of,
it is, it's almost comical. It's, like, well, it's almost also a spoof of it.
Yeah. Specifically these two women. It's very much like the Bette Davis,
Joan Crawford.
Joan Crawford, thank you. Like, the feud. Like, I definitely think it was trying to explore that more, which is why, to me, it is so successful. It's, like, high camp. Whereas this movie... same with Hello.
It's a commentary.
I just don't think.
I think it's like they're actually making a commentary on the way women are, making fun of how people think women are.
Yes, and right. it's one of those like very cheap ways of sort of like, well, women say that like there's too much like violence against them in movies, so instead of making all of the villains like male rapists, we'll make them female. Bitches or,
yeah,
or like, whatever just... but it's like how about you just like
why not
just
have
why
no
does
villain?
Why does every man have to sexually threaten a woman
maybe like, the man wants to be the drama okay maybe he wants to steal your man okay
maybe
make
just...
him a gay white male
or like, just make him a dickhead without like threatening her bodily or I don't know but yes it's just like a paltry imagination for a concept of how people's lives are lived and it doesn't wouldn't require imagination all you would have to do is talk to like four women
and
like,
I think that
just,
there would be
that's
less
it.
Women maybe I'm wrong but like I feel like they're just it's not good to see that kind of stuff like the competitiveness on screen because there is a period in time when like everybody's competitive against everybody like in high school right everyone is competitive. And it does end. Like, it's like for
but
me.
But also,
it
like,
does.
It should have never started because it's just like a false sense of seeing the world as a zero sum game when it's not. That's not that way. The other thing is this, how many women have you met in your lifetime? And they'll be like, I don't really like every other women. I just get along with guys better compared to how many men have you ever met? They're like, I don't really get along with other men. I just prefer, like, it's so fucking rare. And if they are, almost invariably, they are gay men. Like, I don't really like hanging out with straight men. Because they're assholes.
But
I'm down to hang out with other men. Like, exactly. And that's because, like, violence has been acted on them. Instead, I do feel women...
I have heard women say that, like, oh, I don't...
Tons!
I mean, I don't get along with those women very frequently. Because
I never
other women.
Because it comes from a place of insecurity that I feel is perpetuated by media presentations of what women are like. Like, we've talked about it before, how, like, you had a long time thinking that as someone who, like, liked to wear makeup and liked to be more glam or... dressed up like that, women who weren't like that judged you, or I on the opposite side as the person who doesn't really like to wear makeup feel judged. And it's like, nobody's judging anybody. Nobody gives a fucking shit.
It's
if anybody.
In movies, women are judging people
for
that
constantly.
And I
constantly.
Just don't.
I
think that that is what men.
It's false.
I do think that women have complicated relationships. I also, not complicated. I think women
I've heard of women being kind of backstabby with friends of mine and stuff. I've not ever experienced it super directly.
I feel women pay attention more and care more about the people who are around them. So if you have a friend, and like 99% of your friendship's great, and then one thing that they're annoying, that's all people. I would say 85% of my personality is annoying. And so I'm sure there's lots of things that when people want to hang out with me, when they're done, they're like, hey, bro, like, I have to get this off my chest. I was with Amanda today.
But the thing is, like, nobody's
so annoying. Sure they do. Like, you ever have a conversation, you're like, oh my God, I love so-and-so, but holy shit, they did this thing in a restaurant and drove me crazy. You just want to get it out. And I think because women...
Maybe to your partner, I suppose.
To your partner. To your partner or a
But that's just, like, that's, like, bullshit venting about stuff
venting.
That you're not really serious
not
about.
Not shit-talking. It is a very different thing than gossiping and shit-talking. But I do think women more... pay attention more, care more, process feelings more, and do need that thing where, like, I just need to tell, like, I gotta text my husband, or I gotta text, like, the one, like, my friend from college who met this other friend one time, and they're
not
friends.
Yeah.
So not it's
like,
a safe,
no circle friend.
Right. No, because you never want to like say something like, I'm going to burden you with this thing about a mutual friend and now you feel uncomfortable. Yeah. It's something dumb like, they made a weird demand about salad dressing. It's something. It's not like, I think my friend is a bad person. I have definitely said stuff like that. And like,
they were weird about the ordering their food at the restaurant.
Or like, you want to talk something out. You're like a little paranoid. You're like, Joan said this thing. What do you think about it? And so I do think.
Do you think she hates me because she said that?
And I think stupid, self-absorbed men see these instances and take it as women hate each other. I'm like, no. Like, we care enough to think about them when they're not around. Unlike your best friend who you've only hung out with.
You can't even talk to about your relationship because you don't talk to dudes about that kind
of
stuff.
Who you haven't talked to in 14 years. Like, oh yeah, my best friend. Who? Joe. Who's Joe? Oh, we were in science class together in sixth grade. Have I ever met Joe? No, we haven't spoken since like 1998. But somehow they're your best friend. You're crazy. Like, you don't even know.
Like, women have to hold the emotional burden of all women in their lives and men in their lives, because men in their lives, they don't talk to the male friends. They talk to their female friends.
For their female friends. And I think that's the other thing, talking about earlier about how emotional intimacy and physical intimacy and sexual intimacy are different things. That's because men think all intimacy is, it's all one thing, and only women can do it. Like, they can't touch, they can't hug their friends. That's why they, like, have, like, punch them. Like, I'm craving physical touch, so I'm going to play football. You know, right. Like... Yeah. I can't talk about my feelings.
I've only been with one guy, but I remember him like complaining to me once. He's like, his friend talked to him about like some sort of girl drama he was having. He's like, I don't know why he's talking to me about that. And I was like, because he's your friend.
Lunacy.
He's like, he should have like girlfriends to talk to about that kind of stuff.
Yeah, or just sort of like, oh yeah, I've hung out with this guy 3 times a week for 15 years. I don't know if his parents are alive or dead. Like,
what? I hung out with like a group of guy friends, and then like we were all like chit chatting, and then this one guy, they've known each other from since high school. Oh, I never knew that about you, and like something came up in conversation that was like so normal,
very
to know
basic
about.
Yeah, like what like, they majored in
that,
in
the fact that they had a sibling.
Oh my god,
sometimes so I meet my brother's friends, they're like, oh, I didn't know Justin had a sister, and I'm like, cool.
It's deranged. Cool. But I do think like there's something about getting it back to Working Girl, there is something about movies like this that, you know, some people say like, oh, you look at things too intently, but I feel like giving something a second life as a different way of viewing something that maybe it was presenting before. It's like history, you know what I mean? Like looking at things through a different light. I don't think it invalidates them as art or as something of value to watch. But I do think sometimes one of my hardest challenges with the show is when I am judging something, like, how much work does someone have to put into something to get that out of it? And I do think that's different for everybody, and it also depends on what they're looking to get out of something. Like in this movie, I think if you were a child of this era who grew up with a lot of movies with this type of mindset, and like, it's like if you grew up with John Hughes movies, you really got to turn off a lot of part of your brain, but there's still the nostalgia there that's going to like... you know, nourish you. But there's also times like it's just as valid to want to go into something and being like, I'm walking away with like an interesting critique on late 80s American capitalism and views of toxic masculinity and gender expectations. Like, you could do a dissertation on this movie. And so like, yeah, it is interesting to get into that and think like, what makes a movie good? Like, and that's different for anybody, because like there's movies I'll say like, is that movie good? Like, no, I would never recommend anybody hate it or watch it, but I hate it so deeply and so artistically I could write a book about it, and so therefore I love it. Like, you know, like it is a very,
you hate
complex,
it so much that you now you're so thankful you have that topic to talk about.
Yes,
you can complain about it.
Absolutely. So we previously had kind of set up like a vote, and we had different, you know, different categories and stuff. But I really feel the conversation this time has been really excellent, and I don't really want to go into that. So I just love to hear, like, what do you got? Like, even if you cannot make a definitive cherish or perish, where are you at? Where are your thoughts? What do you think of this movie, having now discussed it twice for like about like my collective 7 hours of discussion of Working Girl?
For me, there's a lot more perish. I still cherish the movie, but there are a lot of things that I think about now watching with my 2022 eyes than with my, you know, 1988-89 eyes, which I had absolutely no idea of any of the stuff that I was watching back then. I'm just like, oh, yeah, the lady got the job. Yay. Yeah. She's got a window. Yay.
Totally.
You know, and it's like, and I had that whole like Harrison Ford really did it for me, like in my youth, and so I forgave a lot of stuff. Like, oh, isn't that sweet that he didn't try to have sex with her? Like, you know,
yes!
Like, yep. I mean, that good the guy. Bar is so low, yeah.
So low.
It's like, oh, so
the bar is Han Solo. I'm sorry if you just stop listening to this podcast now. You can write your hate mail to cherishapod
at gmail.com. I'm out.
But I do feel like at the end of the movie, like I really, all the shop talk or whatever, I like when she's telling how she got to that idea. Mm-hmm. I think it's important. It shows how smart she is. It's, yes, she is looking at a Dear Susie column with a beautiful picture of Trask's daughter who's going to get married, and she talks about the gross DJ who might leave Metro, which is the radio station that they want to buy, and if he leaves Metro, it's just some, you know, it's just
worth it.
It's
worth
dead this. Air, yeah. Basically. I love that. I love the fact that she, because she's able to rattle it off so easily, like she comes across as genuine, smart, and she impresses the fuck out of that old man in how,
he's like a nice guy.
In an elevator speech, right? The time it takes to get from the first floor to wherever the office is. And for that, I will always cherish this movie. I think that it inspired me. It inspired me the same way that it inspired that Bob's Burgers writer who did the episode about Work Hard or Die Trying Girl with the Die Hard Working Girl musical, where Bob says something like, this is the movie that made me believe that I could do whatever I could be whatever I wanted to be in life. And I was like, that is, we could be best friends. Whoever wrote that line and I should be BFF. Like,
me too.
Yeah, because I did. I came away feeling like, okay, I could do that. I mean, obviously my life has changed. I do not want any part of day trading. But I do like the sense of she works hard. She deserves what she gets, and she gets what she deserves. And it's not in a bad, like, she got what she, no, she deserves to be respected for her intelligence, for her business acumen. And if she, whatever she wants to wear to get it, she can do that.
She can do whatever she wants in that power suit.
That's right.
Yeah, for me, I'm still kind of on the fence. I think ultimately, if I have to think about, like, overall, like, do I want to put this movie on and watch it again? I would have to say no, and thus, like, a perish for me. But, like, there are so many things that this is like representational for that, like, decontextualized from this overall movie, I think are awesome. Like the idea of kind of a class solidarity. Like, she had come from the trenches and did not want to treat her secretary the same way. And like that one thing, talking about Catherine coming from utter privilege, is like, she would never have worked in these trenches. I wish they had gotten into a little bit more about other people there, of like what their experiences were and things. But I loved the class aspect of that. I love that ending. I love this idea of, while the character or the relationship between Catherine and Tess ultimately disappointed me, I do like that there are other working women who are, you know, in the fight and with her and supporting her and like cheering her along. Like, all those secretaries like cheering in the little typist pool at her old job and stuff like that. Like that felt really awesome. But I do think like from a perspective of thinking of like the ways women are portrayed in the workplace, the way men are portrayed in the workplace, I think it's a fascinating time capsule because it is an intriguing narrative. Like it's not a documentary by any means, but like there's so much that happens in this movie that is exploring so many binaries that I feel that we have eschewed at this point in history, so many stereotypes and cliches I feel that we are moving beyond, but not to the point of like these people don't exist, but I think that we are looking at stories that used to be so flattened in a much wider way. There was that one show, like, I don't know if the show necessarily worked for me, but Kevin Can Go Fuck Himself. Like, that was a really interesting look at the ways that very specifically, like King of Queens, Everybody Loves Raymond, like this suburban New York, usually of like an ethnic group, Italian American, Irish American, that have like strong cultural ties to their countries of origin, like the way they are portrayed. I think The Sopranos was something that tried to show a little bit about American life, Italian American life outside of the mafia, though directly in the mafia. Like, it's been a very different way of telling stories since this movie came out, even though it's, like, telling the same stories of the very people in this show. Like day traders. Like, people dealing with a lot of money and what their lifestyle is like compared to what their clients are like. I do think that that is really interesting. And I think this is an interesting stepping stone in how we're showing these stories. Also, fashion montages, I'll take those anytime. Like, bring them back. Like, but it is ultimately, I think last time I did cherish it because I think it's a satisfying ending. But, and again, how I criteria cherish or perish changes every episode. In this case, like, maybe I'm chasing a unicorn. Maybe the cherish in this rubric I'm using right now does not exist yet. But we can do better. We can and we have, and maybe it takes a cobbling together of multiple properties. I feel we can. I feel Mike Nichols did better, possibly looking at some of his older movies or more recent movies. But yeah, so ultimately, Parrish for me.
Parrish?
It was a
changing
Parrish.
It up.
I think I am changing it up. I am changing it up. Yes. What about
I'm gonna
you?
I'm going to keep it the same as I did last time we recorded, which was a Parrish.
Which a Parrish, yeah.
It was a Parrish. I really disliked the Catherine's character. It really ruined it for me. Just because I really liked the, like you guys are saying, the ending was great. Like the overall idea was great. Just some of the execution, some of the pieces, like, it was just a little bit too cringy for me. A little bit too, it's like just missing the mark. Like, you know, like you're like, I see what you're trying to do here, but I think you're not doing it great, you know? And so, yeah. Like, but maybe it was good for the time, but it's not good for today. And that's the lens I'm looking at this time. So.
Yeah, I'm curious, like, how, I don't want to say groundbreaking, but, like, yeah, I do feel that this would have been an untapped story in 1988 compared to a lot of other kind of things that were happening. But, like, you, like, again, there's always these things where I'm looking at it, like, the way certain things resolved, like, we're in a kind of more business-focused drama. But then everything kind of wraps up a little too, like, John Hughes movie. And so it's like, are you simplifying this because you think that women are simple and this is what they want? And like, we can't handle a complex ending. There's too many questions like that for me. Like, that I'm like, am I overthinking this? Or was this underthought before being given to the audience? Like, I'm not sure.
I would say yes to the underthought. I think one of the things about this movie to me is that it's meant to be a modern fairy tale, a Cinderella story. And you tie those fairy tales up with a bow at the end. The Disney versions, not like the Grimm's versions, and where, like, somebody dies on the rocks.
It is a female villain.
Yeah.
And the Disney version, a woman is killed by like a swarm of crows or whatever. Who knows? We're like, yeah, a giant rock falls on her, or
a house.
Yeah. A house. Yeah. Yeah. The only other woman we get to see also has to die. So, yeah.
Right.
For one to reign supreme. So that is two parishes and a cherish on this one. A little switcheroo if we had had our last episode. So if you had preferred that there would be more cherishes for this movie, maybe we'll release the bad audio of our first released episode.
See how many times we repeated ourselves and see how many times, God, how much stuff we didn't say this time that we said last time.
Who knows? Any recommendations for the people? Mine remains the same. It's probably COVID. If you don't feel good, it's probably COVID. Get tested. Just stay home. Wait till you get your symptoms over. I mean, definitely. People are still dying of COVID. But if you are vaccinated, otherwise pretty healthy, if you're out and about right now with no cares, have a little bit of cares. Bring back a few cares. Just so you're not getting everybody diseased before they go on their summer trips. What about you? What any recommendations?
I still have the same one too. It's a talk to people if you want to talk to them.
Yeah.
And I'm talking about like friends that you haven't talked to in a long time. You know, people that you think, oh, it's been too long. I can't talk to them. Or if you're out and about, you're like, that person looks cool. I wish I was the kind of person who would talk to somebody I don't know. You know, just try to be that person. I can't most of the time. But I think we should.
Complete strangers, I have a bit of trouble with like a friend. I've definitely been trying, especially since lockdown, because I'm fucking at home on my phone all day. If somebody pops into my mind, I like to send a quick message or like, you know, a DM, whatever, with thought about you today. Hope you're doing well. That's it. Boom. They don't have to respond if they don't want to. You're not asking a question that's like waiting out there, but you just let somebody know you're on my mind and I thought about you. And I don't hate your guts.
And I'll only be mildly obsessive about it if you don't respond.
I try to do it just like fast. Like send out quick and then I can just move on with it and I'll probably forget. And then what will happen is they'll respond back later and I'm like, who the fuck's messaging me?
This douche.
This motherfucker. Oh, yeah.
I started this.
Oh, it was me.
The motherfucker is me.
My recommendation was keep track of your feelings. I have trouble with intrusive thoughts, and my brain loves to remind me of what a terrible, terrible person I am on a regular basis. And it will get me to feel very down. But when I sit with that and I really think about it and I change the way that I'm thinking about it and put some context around it, it makes it, I don't know, it changes it. It doesn't give those intrusive thoughts that you don't really have a lot of control over the power that it would if you just let it be. So I have an app that I use where it, at 3:30 every day, it reminds like, how are you feeling? And it gives you like the five, like the, I'm very sad, not sad. I'm okay. I feel good. And I feel great. And I found out by logging these feelings that most of the time I'm in like a 3 or 4. I think I've had 1 5 and I think I've had 1 2, but there are days where I could have sworn that I was a 1 and I was not. So it is just kind of like reframing the thoughts that you're having and, rewriting your narrative. Don't let like your brain sometimes thinks that it's protecting you by telling you not to do things or not to go for your dreams test, just to stay home, you know, don't go to night school.
Like mine are always like, oh, hey, you know what? You need to prepare for every argument you're ever going to have with anybody you might ever meet. So let's just go through some scenarios right now and get yourself all worked up emotionally. And so, yeah, like that's a big reason I started journaling was like, give me my brain back to think about shit that is real and matters and I care about. And like, you know, there's so many reasons we all do this, like our childhood, like our protective little shells or whatever. Yeah, I 100% agree. Like, seeing your thoughts like right now, like sometimes it'll even stop me like, do I care enough to keep thinking about this to write it? Like if I write it, it becomes real. What if I just like banished it forever? And like sometimes that has worked and it's like, wow, that's awesome. Like when you actually accept that you have feelings and like try to like feel them and work through them as opposed to just being like, nope, squash it down. Let me go on buy some shit on Amazon and then watch fucking Nailed It. Smoke weed. Yeah, exactly. I mean, you can also smoke weed and journal. It's great. I suggest.
Oh, no, no. But, yeah.
But yeah, definitely.
There are good reasons to smoke weed.
For sure. And especially, like, you know, it's so easy to be like, get therapy or get da-da-da. Like, that's not always accessible. Just also,
sometimes you have it.
You gotta still pay for therapy every day. It's $50 a fucking half hour or whatever you're gonna be paying. No, like, it helps.
$50?
Like, at the end of the day, yeah.
That's cheap.
Yeah. You gotta... I was thinking, like, you go on, like, BetterHelp. I think some of the cheapest little things are, like, 20 minutes for $50. It's not cheap. Even then, your therapist is going to tell you, like, you got to work on this on your own. You're the only one thinking your thoughts. Like, it's all your circus. Like, all the flamingos, monkeys, and clowns are yours. You know what I mean? Like, you get to tell them what to do, you know, or at least try to corral them as much as possible. But yeah, right. For sure. Awesome. These are all great things. What might also be good, or maybe not, is the movie we're going to be doing next, which is Drowning Mona. Did you forget that we had picked that movie last time that we discussed this?
I didn't forget.
I definitely did see this movie when it came out, but I have so much of this movie, Throw Mama from the Train and The War of the Roses mixed up in my head. I think all of these...
The War of the Roses one's a little bit of a...
Totally. But I think it also has Danny DeVito in it.
But
and
the
that
Throw
is why it's
Mama from a Train is like a pretty direct...
relationship to this one. Oh, interesting.
Well, I mean, I just feel like because it's like she's like a mom to like Drowning Mona is like a mom, and she's like I feel like it's similar in the way that like the
people
mom's
are
not like
kill
necessarily likable, yeah. You know, yes, so yes. Kind of a thing. I mean, it's been a long time since I've seen either of those movies. I think I've seen this one more times though than Throw Mama from the Train.
Throw Mama from the Train, I've definitely seen 50 times at least in my lifetime. It is one of the favorites. I think I might still have my VHS copy from like my childhood. Nice. Mama from the Train. It's basically Strangers on the Train. Strangers on a Train, but dumb.
Intentionally
much more comedic version of Strangers on the Train. It's great. So Drowning Mona, that will be our next movie. If you have a movie you want us to talk about, we would love to hear what it is. You can email it to us at cherishorperishpod@gmail.com. Direct message us on Instagram or just shout really loud. And maybe we'll hear it. I don't know where you live. So maybe I'll just hear
if
like
you're in
next
the Pacific
door,
Northwest.
There's a good chance. No, it's not. I mean, a better chance than if you're somewhere else. If you're in the Pacific Northwest, that's the best chance we will hear you if you shout. That's all I can say about that. Thank you so much for listening to our show. Thank you so much, Jess, for coming back on again and redoing this all over again for us to dissect your favorite childhood film and call it a sexist piece of garbage. I really didn't think that. Thank you to you listeners for coming back week after week. We love you so much. And we will see you next episode. Bye.
Bye. Bye.